Okay, that's it for now. I'm now going to introduce our first speaker today, and that is Dave Rollison. Dave taught history and politics at the University of New South Wales and the University of Western Sydney from 1975 until 2008. Took retirement and is now an independent scholar, currently based at the University of East Anglia as an associate research fellow, where he's working on a book called What is Social History? What he's going to be talking to us about today is a book he's currently got at the publishers at the moment, which is called The Commonwealth of All the Peoples, England's Long Social Revolution.
Popular politics and England's long social revolution.
England's popular politics and long social revolution, 1066 to 1649. Dave is also the author of The Local Origins of Modern Society, which is a study of the development of industry and capitalism in the countryside, using a case study of Gloucestershire. So Dave's very familiar, he's effectively a local historian, and has done an enormous amount of work on Gloucestershire records, so anything north of the river is his bag. And I'd like to give us a radical history group. Welcome to Dave Rollison, please. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. I'd like to thank Dave for inviting me to this amazing venue. What I'm proposing to do today is to kind of start off with a summary of where the book started from, and what it argues, and then read a couple of sections from it, which includes somebody I think who's got some claims to being one of the first recorded activists in the labour movement, an episode that took place in the 1350s, shortly after the Black Death, and also talk about the traditional rebellion which leads up to it, and in my argument leads up to 1649. The theme of the book in some ways is could be argued as a commoning of English constitutional culture, which I argue is a process that begins essentially with the vernacularisation of English culture in the 14th century, and is promoted very vigorously by the tradition of rebellion from 1381 to 1649. So essentially I see the Peasants' Revolt of 1381 and all the other rebellions between then and 1649 as being part of a single process and part of a single movement, which, for any of you who know the recent historiography of the English Revolution, is, in this context, a fairly radical radical argument. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about where this book started from. In 1995, the Prime Minister of Australia, Paul Keating, formally announced his support for an Australian Republic. In the course of his speech to the House of Representatives, he rejected monarchy and all other formal survivals of empire. His only concession to the European and British past was, I quote, that the Australian Republic retained the name Commonwealth of Australia. Commonwealth is a word of ancient lineage which reflects our popular tradition and our federal system, he said. A couple of years later, an Australian novelist, David Malouf, some of you may have heard of him, he's of Lebanese-Irish extraction, expanded on Prime Minister Keating's theme. Any argument for a republic based on the need to make a final break with Britain will fail, wrote Malouf. This is not because people want to preserve the tie, but because breaking it is neither here nor there. The republic will be accepted because we need, as a society, to reinforce our bonds with one another, not break our bonds elsewhere. Bonds of affection and concern that celebrate the gift of one another's presence and make the community one, as Federation, a century ago, made the continent of Australia and the nation one. And we will use for this notion of res publica the good old English word Commonwealth, as our founding fathers did, rather than the Frenchified Republic. This is Malouf. These are Malouf's words. Nothing very terrible has ever happened under a Commonwealth. The same cannot be said for a republic, as many newer Australians, who are pretty familiar with their own histories, if not with ours, have good reason to recall. It seemed to me that Malouf's words are worth repeating and remembering for the nobility of the sentiments they express. But evocations of tradition ought to make historians, citizens and radicals prick up their ears. Prime Minister Keating's passing reference was the beginning of an inquiry which has taken me from 1995 up until this year, when I completed the book actually last month and sent it off to the publishers. That was the beginning of this inquiry. I was actually teaching a course at the time on political thought, and I used Keating's, when one of the themes of political thought then and now is the uses of the political language. What's in a word? What does a word mean? The choice of a word. How do words galvanise people? How do ideas galvanise people? And so it seemed to me that this was this idea of Keating's, that we should still call ourselves a commonwealth, was an interesting one, and it was one that I could use as a contemporary event to get students interested. All right, if I put this on, it's not going to fly out of the air. Okay. All right. So the first thing I did was to, as a historian does, is to look to try and trace the word Commonwealth to its origins, and it didn't occur to me that it was going to take me as long as it did to find the word, because I knew a little bit about it from the book that I'd written and the work that I'd already done on early modern England from 1500 to 1800, and the word Commonwealth is a word that comes up all the time. It's very difficult to find a document, or at least a literary document, that doesn't use the word Commonwealth, that also doesn't use the word commonalty. Commonalty is, I think, a slightly archaic word now, but it was I've since found out that the word was originally a word that came into use in the 14th century, when English, of course, was becoming the national language, not just of the common people, but also of the elites. And I've got a chapter in the book called The Power of a Common Language, and language is very much tied up with this process. Language and ideas are a crucial part of this. And I knew that the word Commonwealth had been first used, it was famous for being used by Tudor propagandists, especially associated with Protector Somerset at the time of the 1549 revolts, in particularly the one, the best known of the 1549 revolts, of course, is the one that took place in and around Norwich. And it was a word used by people like Sir Thomas Smith and almost all of the writers and statesmen surrounding Henry VIII and Protector Somerset and Edward VI and so on. We're using this word Commonwealth as a word for, I guess the nearest analogy would be the word society. It means everything and it can mean anything. And everybody uses it, and it was also a good word. It was a word that if you use the word Commonwealth, everybody said, yeah, we're for that. We're all in favour of a Commonwealth. But, of course, it's being used right across the political spectrum by everybody. So, in the traditional provenance of the word Commonwealth, it's an elite word. It's an intellectual's word. It's used by intellectuals in the 16th century. And the earliest usage of the word Commonwealth with a hyphen in between it was by William Tyndale in the Bible translator in the 1520s. He used the word Commonwealth quite frequently in his propagandist works. And William Tyndale was pretty much a radical. And he was also somebody who took his language from the people. He almost made a fetish of this idea that the language that he used, he wanted to write a Bible that would be able to, that weavers and ploughmen would be able to read, as he put it. And so when he's using this word, it seemed to me, well, if he uses the word Commonwealth, then it's probably a word that's in wide currency. It's not just a word. And that's the 20 or 30 years before the Tudor propagandists use it. To cut a long story short, since then I've been able to trace it back to 1381. It seems to me, I've put an argument in the book, that the first people to use the word commonweller or commonweeler, that's the weller is spelled W-E-L-E, and common is spelled C-U-M-U-N usually, or words or spelling for or spelling, so I'm not saying in those days. So the 1381 rebels seem to have been the first people to have used it. There's a chronicler in 1381, who says with great disgust that the rebels of 1381 had proclaimed that they were fighting for the communis utilitatem. Of course, the chronicler was writing in Latin, he was a monk. So we don't know for sure what was meant by that. But communis utilitatem means common good or common weal. Now, there are five letters written by the rebels of 1381, and they use the word wella. Eight times in those letters. They frequently use it as a word with great resonance. It means something like wellness, health. It's also used by one of the great vernacular theologian of the late 14th century. Not many people, anybody. Are you familiar with Julian of Norwich? Julian of Norwich was a great vernacular theologian. She uses the word wella in a very spiritual context. It's a word that Christ used. She has a vision of Christ, and she cites Christ as using this word to describe what he is going to bring to the world. He is going to bring wella to the world. And she uses this word repeatedly in an almost poetic sense, so which enabled me to say, with a lot of other looking into the provenances of Middle English words, but it is the commonwealth or commonwella is a word which is being used in the late 14th century and almost certainly used as the key word of the 1381 revolt. Now, I then look back into the provenance of the two words common and wella. Common, commune, of course, is a hugely important word. It's another word which you can barely read any text without coming across it in one of its usages. And it has multiple usages. It comes from, usually it's traced back to the Norman French usages. Now, if you trace the Norman French usages of common, then what you get is an elite provenance. Because French and Latin are the languages used by the ecclesiastical and the secular elites up to the end of the 14th century. But in fact, this word also has a parallel in vernacular English, early vernacular English, which is effectively not written down until the beginning of the 14th century. And the word is imeen. I'm not quite sure how they pronounced it, and I don't think anybody does know that. But that comes from the Germanic, so that it's almost certainly a word which has, as a traditional English linguists say, it's got two origins. Probably got a popular origin, which is the Germanic version, and the Latin and Norman French origin. So you can trace that word through to 1381 and bring those two words. Wheeler is a word with great spiritual significance in the Middle Ages. Of course, religion is immensely significant. As religion encompasses what we would call ideology today and theory. Political thought, all of those things are encompassed by theology, so theology is an important factor in it. So we're talking about something which indicates spiritual welfare as well as material comfort and so on. So if you think about that transition, what you've got is what appears to be a change that takes place around 1520, around the beginning of the 16th century, from an old English word which has these very large connotations of wellness, of health, of the wellness of the common body, and so on and so forth, to a much narrower conception, wealth, wella to wealth. So you've got this transition from common weal or common wheeler to common wealth. And of course, this period is exactly the period when Marx talks about the transition to capitalism. Marx says in Capital Volume 1 that the capitalist system was born in the generations of Sir John Fortescue and Sir Thomas More, which is approximately from 1550 to 1638, or whenever it was that he was killed. So there is a linguistic transition that takes place at around the time when, in the traditional Marxist view, capitalism is born. Now, of course, some of you may pick this up. There are a lot of arguments going on within Marxist thought, or between Marxist and post-structuralist thought, that Marxism is if you take the basic base and superstructure model, of Marxism, then language is sort of structural. The argument that myself and quite a number of other historians of early modern, Marxist-inspired historians of early modern England have been arguing is that this is in fact a rather narrowing view of things that language and material structures are. But ideology and material forms, landscapes and so on, are part of the same mode of production. You can't isolate language and ideas from... So the post-structuralism and historical materialism are not... they're not oppositions. They are perfectly compatible with each other, as long as when we analyse them, we look at how they work and how they operate together. In other words, there's a dialectical relationship between material developments and linguistic developments. And in the book, I try to do both of those two things. I talk about the development of language, the development of ideology, theology, and so on. But I also talk about the development of industry, of industrial, when industry, being one of the chapters that I have is about the when how industry became a state policy, when states first started to talk about economic policies, and that is in the middle of the 16th century. That's when it first begins. So we're talking about a very long process. And the backbone of this process, I argue, is the tradition of rebellion. There are all sorts of underlying cultural transitions that take place. This is the idea of a long social revolution between 1066 and 1649. But essentially, I think 1381 and 1649 are crucial dates. There's the vernacular movement, which is immensely important and has almost never been analysed by linguists and so on as having political significance. The linguistic transition, the birth of modern English, or Middle English as they used to call it, has almost always been described as a literary movement. I argue very strongly, and I think that I've got plenty of evidence for it. I think the only reason that it hasn't been done before is nobody's ever tried to do it before. Once you look at where the language came from, what you see is Middle English is actually an English that people with different dialects and different accents use when they meet in the marketplace, when they meet people from different areas. And that what the literary figures of the late, the great William Langland and Chaucer and Julian of Norwich and so on, what they're doing is they're using the language that they find in the streets, that they hear, that they've grown up with. And when they want to write English, they want to reach as large an audience as they can. So they naturally don't use a very strong dialect, although of course you do have different dialects. Dialectical literatures. What they do is they use a Middle English, and what Middle English means is not medieval English, English between Anglo-Saxon and modern English. What Middle English means to me is Middle English between, as a mediating form, between the dialects. It's what people use normally. So which kind of breaks down that old idea that there was a folk tradition over here where people were told like that, and nobody understood what they said, and so on. And over here you've got literary figures who are formulating a nicely rounded English language that people at universities and so on, and academics and intellectuals and statesmen can understand. So what I've tried to do is break down that tradition that folk, that the people who were recorded in the 19th century as speaking Gloucestershire speech or whatever, wherever they were actually simply isolating the language that they used amongst themselves, not the language that they used in the marketplaces and the streets when they were talking to people. The argument being that if you go to India today, or if you go to Australia today, if you go out into the Nullarbor and talk to Aboriginals, and go out, if you go to Death Valley in America, or wherever you go, you might not understand what people are saying, because people know they're speaking English, but once they want to communicate with you and you want to communicate with them, you'll understand them. They'll make themselves understood. They'll speak slowly. First time the encounter that I had with some interviews I did years ago with some Scousers. And I found out very quickly that Scousers were very capable of speaking a Scouse that nobody who wasn't a Scouse could understand. But if they wanted to talk to you and they wanted you to understand them, and if they wanted you to understand them, then they would slow down, they would round out their vowels, they would speak in a slower way. So that what I'm kind of doing is writing a sort of social history of the language as part of this process. So vernacularization is a critical part of the process. Language is extremely important. That historical materialism cannot ignore language. And in my book, what I'm arguing is that the ideas are crucial, and that the word commonweal is absolutely crucial for this social revolution that takes, this long social revolution that takes place between 1381 and 1649. The key to that is that every rebellion, and I'll give you a litany of those rebellions in a moment, every rebellion that took place between 1381 and the 1640s was explicitly fought in the name of the Commonwealth, or the Commonwealth. Every single one of them. Nobody's noticed before, again, because I don't think anybody's ever looked, but once you look, what do they say they're rebelling for? What do they say they're fighting for? In every case from 1381, the disgusted chronicler who says, this riffraff of people, so the riffraff is a word that's first used, as far as I know, in 1450 to refer to Cade's rebels. How dare these riffraff say that they're fighting for the communis utilitate, which in Latin sounds incredibly impressive, but when translated, of course they don't speak Latin, the rebels don't speak Latin, so what were they saying they were fighting for? In 1450, Cade's rebels explicitly say, we are doing this for the Commonwealth. All of the other rebellions, there are a number of smaller rebellions, all of them say they're fighting for the Commonwealth. In 1536, the Pilgrimage of Grace, usually seen as a religious rebellion, probably wasn't. It only became a religious rebellion when other people got hold of it and were able to control it. 1549, all of them say they're fighting for the Commonwealth. The word Commonwealth, if you look at the literature of the 1640s, the word Commonwealth is clearly what they're all fighting for. I notice that there's a poster up on the wall there about one of the levellers that was killed was executed in April 1649. It's just around the corner, you have a look in the break. And it says in there that he was a great man who died for the Commonwealth. And you see it in little incidents, you see it in great incidents, and you see it in the chroniclers and the people who write about this, all say they're fighting for the Commonwealth. So what have we got here? We've got a word which is bringing together a whole range of demands and a whole range of local movements. One of the most difficult things to explain about the rebellions of medieval, late medieval and early modern England is how did rebellions from, say, Bristol and from Gloucester and from various other parts of the country, an enclosure riot here, an industrial riot there, a demand for a loosening of manorial demands elsewhere. How did all these things come together when they did in these great rebellions in 1381, 1450, 1536, 1549? How did they all come together? And we know a lot about how they came together in the 1640s, but it's always been a mystery how these movements, how did all these people from East Anglia, how did they know to head for Greenwich? How did all the people from Kent, why did they all meet in London? How did they all come together? I mean, one of the ways in which resistance was killed in feudal England was because it was so localised. So it was very easy to put down a local rebellion. The great rebellions of the late Middle Ages and the early modern period terrified, shattered the ruling class, had a tremendous influence on the way political developments. The state tried to form alliances in 1450 and 1549 with the commons, rebels, which is another story which I'll probably touch on later. So it does influence, it has a massive influence, it's memorialised, it's remembered, this tradition of rebellion. So the rebellion, I argue, is the sharp end of the long social revolution, which is what the book's about. It's about vernacularisation, it's about industrialisation. Not nearly enough has been done on industrial development in late medieval and early modern England. Something like a third of English working men, and that doesn't include their wives and their children, who usually work with them in some way, something like a third by the end of the 16th century are working in manufacturing industries. So that by the end of the 16th century, England is already an industrial society. And it's only recently, I argue that 20 years ago in a book about Gloucestershire, Recently, the Cambridge Group for the Study of the Population and Social Structure has come up with this remarkable new theory that England was an industrialised society in the 16th century, not the 18th and 19th century, so that what we have to do is we have to reconsider what the Industrial Revolution was about. Because if England was already a commercialised and an industrialised society before the Industrial Revolution, then we have to reshape our way of thinking about this whole long process. And that's another of the arguments that I'm putting forward in the book, that we are looking at a long process, which is something that historians are uncomfortable with. And I think this applies to radical historians, Marxist historians, not Marx. But nearly all historians have difficulty. I know this is Peter Linebaugh. Doesn't have that sort of a problem with it. The long process is very important. Changes take place that are invisible to single generations, and they can almost be invisible for always. There is motivation, there is intention involved in them. They say, these people, we are fighting for the Commonwealth. Well, what do they mean by the Commonwealth? And do they achieve it? Is something like that achieved? Well, again, I argue that it is achieved. That by the 1640s, the English culture has been commoned. It is a common culture. The language it uses is English. And if you read Bacon, Hobbes, the great philosophers of the time, they're all saying this. They're all saying this. You've got to be very careful how you use the English language now. You've got to use English, because you've got to try and reach the whole of the English population. It's no good. You know, the polity of England is already by the mid-17th century. Public opinion is an issue in the middle of the 17th century. I've found that public opinion is an issue in the 14th century. That communities are joined by common ideas, which you can trace. Kings, chronologies, annals, and so on. Certain symbolic events are remembered and known by almost everybody in England by the early 14th century. And that this is all carried by language. So that we need to, I think, reconsider the whole grand narrative of English culture. And my argument is that the most obvious, if you stand back from that process, what is the difference between England in 1300 and England in 1649? The difference is that it is a common culture. It's a common culture in the sense that the way that my mother used to use the word, it has those connotations, you know. Don't play with him, he's a common person. Or those neighbours are common people. You know that derogatory usage of the word. Most people of my age have grown up with that usage. And that's a term which comes, of course, from originally feudal times, when aristocratic and monarchical values are, the only thing that matters are what monarchical and aristocratic people think. They are an elite, they're a hereditary elite. They use a special language to communicate. By the 1640s, that is no longer true. Latin no longer carries much sway in politics, still carries a lot of sway in the universities, probably still does in some ways. But it's the vernacular language that counts, it's public opinion that counts. Vulgar ideas, which the great classical scholars and the intellectuals would frown upon, Shakespeare's use of that language, is extremely vulgar. He uses a lot of vulgar terminology. He puts common people on the stage. The idea of putting common people on the stage is a no-no in classical drama. In Renaissance humanists frowned on it. You could only present common people as bores, B-O-O-R-S, and scallywags, and ignorance. They are by definition ignorant. Those connotations are still around, but they've died. England in the 17th century is a much commoner culture. In other words, what we're looking at is part of a process by which popular sovereignty becomes the major issue in global political events. It's part of a process which moves on in the 18th century to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the European revolutions of 1848, and so on, up to the modern period. So there is a long process. And what happens in England between 1381 and 1649, I argue, is absolutely crucial to that process. That process is picked up, sometimes consciously, sometimes not, by the philosophers that influenced the 18th century Enlightenment. They're carried across to France. If you read Voltaire's 18th century letters to the French people about England, one of the points he's making about them, he said, you can't tell aristocrats from ordinary people. He said, a weaver might be wearing the same clothes as a noble. You walk around the streets and you can't tell who's what. It is a common culture. And although the people are not necessarily thinking in that way, most of the common people are, although there's still lots of snobbery and immense amount of class feeling, class, I argue, it comes out of this commoning process. It's a new kind of class that emerges after the English Revolution. So, the long process. It takes a long time to try and work out these and to try to weave in all the different processes in part of it. But I argue there is a causal, we're looking at a causal process, that one thing, as Henry Ford put it, one damn thing does lead to another. That 1381 does lead to 1450. And the people of the rebels of 1450 remember 1381. They're conscious of that. As are the rebels of 1536, conscious of 1450 and 1381. And those of 1549 are conscious of those rebellions before them. And the rebels of the 1640s are constantly remarking on the relationship that they bear to this tradition of rebellion that goes over this period. So it's a remembered process. It's not just a historical process, it's something that is passed on generation after generation. Okay, I hope I've given an idea of the big picture. What I'll conclude by doing is to first of all, I think in this context it's probably appropriate to talk about a hermit, Richard of Fulham, that I discovered when I was doing the research for this. A lot of it was done at the British Museum and the Institute of Historical Research and the usual sorts of places, and it involved looking at literature that had been looked at by all the constitutional history. I had the sense all the time I was doing the research that I was walking in the steps of ghosts. You could almost smell Marx's fingers on Sir Thomas Smith's Discourse of Economy in 1549, for example. You suddenly read that and you think, well, that's where Marx actually says his theory of class struggle. He didn't invent it. He said, I got it from the people that I read. Most of them he read in the British Library. So you get the sense of being haunted. But one of the stories that I came across, and one which, I like the story, and I hope you will too, is a section of the book, I've got a chapter in which I talk about the different demands, but before the national rebellions begin in 1381, what you have is a dispersed situation. You've got lots of small rebellions, but none of them ever come together. None of them ever descend upon London, and none of them explicitly say that they're fighting for some particular national or state, that they're fighting against the state. It's not until 1381 that that happens. So you've got these demands, and what I do in this chapter is to talk about various themes of the 14th century which come together in 1381 under the banner of Commonwealth Act. This section is called The Heretical Hermit of Hertfordshire. Richard of Fulham against the Statute of Labourers. Okay, so we're talking about the decade after the Black Death. One of the most obvious impacts of the Black Death was that it didn't leave enough people to do the work. As soon as the localities began to get over the initial shock of the Great Dying, labour shortages translated into demands by labourers for higher wages. Hertfordshire, like the home counties, Essex, the Thames Valley and the cloth-making districts of the west of England, was part of London's hinterlands. Remember, it took about 1350s. And it was among the first, Hertfordshire was among the first counties to register a dissenting voice with regard to the Statute of Labourers. Do I need to explain the Statute of Labourers?
Maximum wage.
Yes, it's very imposing maximum wages, yeah. This Hertfordshire legend concerns the labour agitations of Richard of Fulham, a hermit, Eremetica, he's described in the sources, and his comrade Robert Gerard, the vicar of the village of Albury. Now, just a quick word about the village of Albury. I went there. I'm not all that familiar with Hertfordshire. And I went to Albury and found that it's the village that Stanley Kubrick lived in. It's like the classic English village. There's a pond in the middle of it, you've been there. Stocks, they've still got the stocks there, the pub, you've got to duck down to go into the pub. And it's like the cliché English village, isn't it? Which is ironic in view of this story. On Tuesday the 19th of April, 1356, John Atterley and his fellows, the King Justices for the Ordinance and Statutes of Labourers, gathered at the Hertfordshire market town of Ware to hear the sworn testimony of 12 jurors of the Shire. The role of the jury was to inform the justices of the King's Bench as to the peace or otherwise of the county. But it soon became clear that John Atterley, the judge, and his retainers had already made the acquaintanceship of Richard and Robert a day or two earlier. The jury's spokesman declared Richard of Fulham, a man who was supposed to have renounced the world altogether, a common malefactor. A sense of righteous outrage colours their testimony. Richard had been wandering about with Robert, vicar of Albury Church, night and day, at various times and places, in disguise, dressing in various changes of garments of various kinds, which he changed every day, eluding capture by the sheriff's men for what must have been months, possibly even a year or two. The accent is supposed to indicate quotes. He wanders about, goes into hiding and dodges here and there on the King's Highway, as well as in other places, public and private. Every so often he leaps out of the forest, carrying a long, thick stick, the famous stave. Most recently, waylaying the King's Justices assigned to administer the Statute of Labourers in the county of Hertford. So apparently this bloke leapt out of the forest with his stave and his mate and terrified the King's Justice, who one assumes had a few nights with him. Exact images of Richard the Hermit and Robert the Priest horribly and savagely threatening the justices, and even the jurors themselves, with death and mutilation and arson and other hideous and unspeakable evils, must be left to the imagination. He appears to have caught the imaginations of his contemporaries, a hermit, a man who was supposed to have turned his back on society, surreptitiously and invisibly wandering among the hamlets, villages and little markets of Hertfordshire, suddenly appearing and preaching his message, moving on, leaving behind him knots of men and women, discussing what he said, electing delegates to inform employers that higher wages would have to be paid or the work would not be done. Whirling his stave, fearless of sheriff's men and justices, pouncing on knots of employers and frightening them also to death, he scorned and poured contempt day after day on the King's Statute and Ordinance of Labourers, artisans and servants, made by the said King and his council for the common utility of the realm. He and Robert went around publicly preaching and complaining that all who made the Statute of Labourers supported, agreed to, executed or maintained them, or indicted such labourers, or punished those indicted, or prevented them in any way from exercising their absolute right to obtain whatever wages they could command, even abnormal wages, as they wish, are excommunicate. Imagine their horror at a hermit excommunicating all the respectable peasant employers, nobles, and even the king in the name of the labourers. If he had not existed, it would have been necessary to invent him. Hermits and anchorites were the proletarians of the medieval church. For 2 centuries after the generation of English monastics alive at the time of the Norman Conquest died out, it became very difficult for an English youth to achieve any seniority in a religious order, and legally impossible for a youth of the largely English commonalty even to join. This left a legacy of estrangement that weakened in the 15th century, but there was always to be a potentially explosive strand of English popular opinion with regard to the church. One effect of this exclusion was to enhance the popular prestige of people who adopted the life of a hermit or anchorite. Julian of Norwich was an anchorite. Hermit is a male, anchorite is usually a female. In effect, the only option for a woman or man of the commonalty with a religious vocation. Hermits and anchorites haven't received the attention they deserve from historians of popular religion, culture and politics. They were, in effect, monastics who chose their own vocation. They made an essentially private adult contract and communion with God. In the centuries after the conquest, they were more likely to be English than French. In a recent study of the impact of the Norman conquest on ethnic relations in England, Hugh Thomas stresses the vernacular character of hermits and anchorites. It would be a challenge to find one who was clearly of Norman descent, he writes. It's a fairly important distinction if you assume that at this time the ruling class still speaks French and still see themselves as the descendants of French ancestors. What is insufficiently stressed is their often very public role in the local and district communities whose parish churches they made their homes. I've done some work on Gillian Norwich, and it seems pretty clear that during her lifetime, she only becomes famous in the 20th century, actually, Gillian Norwich. She's known to monastics, a few monastics in the 15th and 16th centuries. But she was very important in Norwich, a very, very important figure. And she was there when the rebels of 1381 took the castle of Norwich. And her hermitage is about 100 metres away from the castle, down in the dockland areas, what were the dockland areas of Norwich. And it's pretty clear that people used to go and visit her like a psychotherapist would, like people would go and read. Go and get therapy today, that that's one of the roles that anchorites and hermits played in the so they're not figures that wall themselves up in churches, they're people who are regularly visiting people seeking advice, men and women seeking advice. So Richard of Fulham is one of these characters, and what we find in 1357, he's preaching, this is the text on which he's preaching. He says this: "There is no statute that would restrict labourers, artisans and servants from taking from their labours and services as much as they are pleased to take and from obtaining what they desire. If it was ordained or decreed otherwise, said statute and ordinance were falsely and wickedly made." That's his text. He's basically saying that the statute of labourers is blasphemy. Now, is this possible? Possible that the jurors are exaggerating, because jurors could get into trouble for paying higher wages, as labourers could get into trouble for demanding higher wages. So they could be exaggerating. They're trying to exonerate themselves for paying these high wages to the labourers, perhaps. So they had reason to exaggerate. But what we've clearly got here, I think, is a division which is institutionalised in society by the middle of the 14th century, 5-6 years after the Black Death, between the land, the barons. What's happening in this document is a class division between the king, the barons, the gentry, proto-gentry, as it was in the 14th century, the liberi homines, the people who would later become the yeomen, and even the tenant farmers, some of them free, some of them unfree. Those are the people with the land on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have the labourers, people who are merely labourers. And they're the people who have benefited from the Black Death, because wages have gone through the roof. And so what he does is clearly addressing the labourers. So we have an early labour agitator. So I think it's said enough. There's more quotes from what he says, and I think you can also argue that he may have been a millenarian. He may have been arguing that God sent the Black Death, that God wanted the wealthy landowners to pay the labourers higher wages, and that was what the Black Death was all about. There's nothing implausible about that. It wouldn't take a genius to work it out, given the mentality of the age, that in fact the Black Death was God's doing. Most people said it was. Okay, so it was God's doing. So God created a world in which labourers were in a position to demand more wages. Nothing implausible about that argument, and I think that's essentially what Richard of Fulham was arguing. And he very possibly was a labourer himself before he became a hermit. We don't know anything about it. It's interesting that he came from Fulham, which is a village not far from west of London in I think Middlesex, but I'm not absolutely sure of that. So he's my kind of contribution to the early history of the Labour movement. How am I doing for time, babe? I'm not sure when I started. How long have I got? Give me a...
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. All right. So let me just conclude by talking about, by summarising this tradition of rebellion. Remember that the story of Richard of Fulham is just one story of many, but an account of the poll tax in Nottingham, another episode in Thornbury, a very interesting Labour movement that took place in Thornbury from the 1320s up to the 1350s, where there are over 700 cases of work done badly, deliberately done badly, in the manorial court records. So there's a kind of a Labour movement going, one kind of Labour movement going on. You've got Richard of Fulham, you've got an episode where in shortly after the death of Edward II in 1327, the citizens of Ipswich murdered their mayor in the same terms, using the same terminology that had been used in the political circumstances surrounding the death, or alleged death, of Edward II in 1327. So you've got this political analogue in the localities and the national picture. There's I've got some accounts of rumours that spread, talk about public opinion, how did word spread in days before print. I've got some stuff on the probably the most important of the 14th century parliaments, the Good Parliament of 1376, in which was a national movement where Parliament actually stands up to the court for the first time. This is 5 years before the Great Rebellion of 1381. And I've got an account of what the poll tax did to local communities, how the poll tax actually changed the way taxation was conducted, and that it affected communal politics very much, and that's why it was such an important factor in the rebellion of 1381. So I'm talking about a process which leads up to 1381, explodes into a national movement, and so on. Okay. So let me summarise the tradition of rebellion, which, remember, is only one thing of the book, but it's the sharp end of the process. Reports attributing political agency to the Commons first appear in English archives relating to Simon de Montfort's common enterprise of the 1250s and 1260s. They recur throughout the reigns of Edward I and Edward II, and reach a crescendo immediately after Edward II's disappearance in 1327. They become a conventional pretext of House of Commons petitions throughout the long reign of Edward III. Another crescendo begins with the Good Parliament of 1376, explodes in 1381, and was sustained virtually without respite, roughly from the Commons Rebellion until Jack Sharp's minor but notorious rebellion of 1429. Another crescendo peaked during the Furiness, the word Furiness is used in the Chronicles, of Cade's Rebellion in 1450, and became the basis of a burst of strategic magnate populism throughout the 1450s and 1460s. Dangerous words turned into popular rebellion again in 1469, 1485, and 1497. It's one that Dave would be very familiar with, the Cornish Rebellion. And rebellions approaching the scale and public consciousness of 1381 and 1450 erupted in the Northern Rebellions of 1536 and once again in several regions in 1549. In this socio-political long term, 1381 marks an obvious turning point. It was the first time the common people rose in rebellion without the leadership and encouragement of magnates. In the period from Magna Carta to the deposition of Edward II, magnates led and commons followed. After 1381, the commons led and the governing ranks had to react. After 1549, renewed efforts were made by all the propertied ranks to end or minimise the unwanted intervention of common people in affairs of state. Now, you may have, if you're interested in the ideology that was associated with this movement, I've got something, I haven't said anything about that, but Andy Wood's recently written a book about the 1549 rebellions in which he's unpacked the ideology that was involved in all of these rebellions. What were they on about? It's often been said they're not really against anything, they're just reformist, they're backward-looking. Andy, and I agree entirely with him, he's... shown, but in 1549. And this is what happens with these rebellions. Each one is better documented than the last one. So in a sense, every rebellion is a way of retrospectively looking back on the previous one and raises questions about the early ones, which brings me to the final point about the 1640s. Why 1649? Why is 1649 the end of this process? Remembering that it began as an account of the provenance of the Commonweal ideology, of Commonwealth ideology. What happens in the 1640s is that Commonwealth is again the key word that is used to unite all of the different ranks in the parliamentarian forces. What happens in 1649, of course, is that the king is executed in the name of a Commonwealth. After 1649, England became a Commonwealth. After the 1650s, the word Commonwealth could never again be used as a radical keyword, because in the 1650s, Commonwealth came to mean, almost unambiguously, the state. Commonwealth was the state, and it also becomes then a part of traditional English republican language, which is elitist, of Shaftesbury and so on. They're using the word Commonwealth. So after the 1640s, the movement of the Commonweal, or the discourse of the Commonweal, as you might call it, dies. Because, for a very simple reason, it can never be used again to unite popular forces. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for all of that, Dave. Really fascinating stuff, particularly on the very early origins you've identified of Labour activism and the Labour movement. We've got time for a few questions. Once Dave's wet his whistle a little bit with a glass of water. If there's any questions for Dave out there, then indicate and you'll try to answer them for 5 minutes. Or any points you want to make to him, anything you want to take to you. Yes, sir, in front row.
Said about the nascent capitalism developing earlier, because you could say that from the dissolution of the monasteries being and the textiles and the enclosures setting up the necessary capital for capital expenditure, so it comes from there. So it's quite interesting when you look at social history about 1620, is you move from the idea of fealty, where you offer fealty to your master, to the idea of work. They invent the idea of work. It never really existed at all. Because you get kind of people complaining, and you get that Nasian industrial revolution with the textiles. So it's, I thought it was quite interesting.
I agree with you. I think that you're right. The only thing I disagree with is the time. I don't think that process has to wait until the 1530s.
Yeah.
William Langham uses the modern sense of work. That people have got to work. He makes a sharp distinction between, and it's a very radical work in other ways. But what he makes a distinction between idlers, between useful, between what's the traditional distinction in the making the poor law records? There are the impotent poor, old people, injured people, and then there are lazy idlers.
Sturdy
beggars, yeah. And Langland is one of the first to make that distinction very sharply. So a lot of the stuff that's talked about in the 1530s and 1540s and enacted in statutes, Henry VIII's legislation, is actually rehearsed in the late 14th century. The late 14th century is an astonishing period when you look closely at it. If you're familiar, I think a lot of the problem is that historians of the 16th century don't know about the 14th century, the 14th century don't know about the 16th century. And so, because I was an early modernist, you start looking at the Wycliffe and the Langland and so on, you start to see that they're actually using the same kind of language, and what's happening in the 100 years later is echoing what's happened before. There's a lot more to be said about your own the traffic, the early English word for commerce, is a critical factor in uniting England from the 14th century on. Not many of us are talking about this now, but it's not an isolated, the communities are not isolated from each other. There is a tremendous amount of traffic between communities, that you have a a whole network of commerce that is uniting the country, which in turn is a carrier of ideas.
One thing I've thought is the other thing that, as you know, is the way the peasantry tied to the land, so you couldn't go out to local wages. So you can move straight from fealty to concepts of work, and there is no real gap in between. So you move from feudalism to native capitalism, because there isn't another way to socially control people.
No.
Apart from indentured a bit in the middle.
Yeah.
There's a process.
Yeah. There's a parallel debate in the 1390s about truth. The key word of another key word of the Peasants' Rebellion, Revolt, 1381, is truth. And it's like truething. And the word truth, there's a crisis. The word truth is in crisis in the 1390s between troth, which is what we're talking about, fealty, honour, respect for a master, loyalty, if you like, and truth as factual, something that is described on a dispassionate angle. So that, again, that debate about fealty, I think you're right, it's just a process which takes longer and which is conscious earlier than has been previously been thought.
I didn't understand that last point about the Commonwealth is no longer with the people, it was the state, something with the king.
Yeah.
But I don't understand that.
The general point I'm making is that the tradition of rebellion is a movement against the state. That there's a movement of the people, or of the community, the commonalty, and of the labouring people against the state. They're rising up on each occasion, and they say, look, it's the Commonwealth versus the state. And it's almost it's impossible. A lot of the people who write about public opinion and civil society say that you can't have public opinions without the state. So that until a state forms, in the modern sense, you have a political opinion in your civil society. Well, the same is true of Commonwealth. The idea of Commonweal, Commonweller, only makes sense when contrasted with a corrupt state. So you've got a state which is supposed to serve the Commonwealth, but manifestly doesn't. So whenever there's corruption in the state, all of the movements come together as rebellions against the state. You wouldn't need what I'm saying about the tradition of rebellion. What happens in the 1640s is that the Commonwealth is a rebellion. Again, they say, we are for the Commonwealth against the kingdom, against the king, against the kingdom, against the royalists, and so on and so forth. So it's a movement again in the Commonwealth against the established traditional state. What happens in 1649 is that the traditional state is decapitated, and the Commonwealth, which until then had been an opposition movement with very strong populist associations, becomes the state. If you then look at what happens in the Putney Debates, which are critical as references to the transition that takes place, there's a debate that takes place between Ireton and Major General, his name now, but one of the Major Generals is Ireton. The argument is between one side of them is saying that every person that is born free has a right to vote. And Ireton, of course, is Cromwell's son-in-law, says, no, I have an right to property. Only those who own property can be voters. Right? So there's this debate that goes on between the propertied and the unpropertied. And there are some who most of the levelers are with Ireton, actually. It's only the radical levelers who are saying that every person with a free, every person born free, every English person, every English male, I think, essentially what they're saying. So, and what emerges from that is a distinction between the property and a new word. There's a new word that comes into play in the late 1640s. The word is mobility. Ireton talks about the settled property and the mobility. And the word mobility becomes the word that is used after the 1650s. To describe the working class, mobility, the mob. the word mob comes from the word mobility. So there, a very sharp class distinction appears within the parliamentarian ranks, as I think is quite well known, in the late 1640s. The victors, Cromwell, Ireton, and the others, form the Commonwealth, the state, a state called the Commonwealth. But it is intrinsically a state that is alienated from the vast number of people that fought for it and had been fighting for it throughout the tradition of rebellion for hundreds of years.
It's like the word they
dropped rather than the movement. There is a change in the movement, that's another issue. I mean, basically, from then on, what you get in the 18th century, as well known, is the riot. It's the age of the riot, not the age of the rebellion or the insurrection. So the rebellion, the rebellious tendency in the medieval period, those great movements which converge on London and even threaten Westminster, they cease. And what you get after that is more localised or regionalised riots. So the rioting tradition is the mob, the mobility tradition. And the reason for that is because there's been a division occurring in the late 1640s, sharpened by consciousness of what's happened in the 1640s. You know, what do we do now? How do we reconstitute the state? Now that the king's gone, well, we can't have the rabble, we can't have the common people coming in. Common people also becomes a term for the working classes in the 1640s for the first time. So you get a division between middle classes and the property middle classes and the working classes. And that alliance is what made rebellions, all the rebellions possible. Whole commonalty fought together in the rebellions of the Middle Ages, including yeomanry and so on and so forth, and the ordinary labouring people. They came together. It was very uninteresting common, but they came together on particular issues. And that's what caused the rebellions. That doesn't happen again. Until I don't know if it happens again. I don't have to leave that to 19th to 20th century historians to say whether the middle classes and the working classes actually ever have had anything in common since then, as a broad generalisation. So you see what I'm saying? That in the 1650s, the Commonwealth becomes what it had been fighting for 500 years. And the people who had supported that ideal up until then are excluded from it. So the Commonwealth explicitly excludes the proletariat, as they were called in the 16th century, workers, the labourers, the landless people. Does that kind of make sense as a sharp division?
Okay, anything else for Dave?
It's about 50 years before the law. 40 years. But yes, there's every chance we have some ideas. The Lollard ideas are around for a long time before they came. Lollard is a sort of generic word that was used by their enemies. Lollard.